From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Bob Woodward's new book, State of Denial, is his third and most critical book about President Bush at war. It describes dysfunctional relationships within the administration and intelligence reports that give a much more pessimistic picture of Iraq than what the president has told the public. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Woodward about the book and the process of writing it. Also, we talk politics and the media with Mark Halperin, political director of ABC News, and John Harris, national political editor of The Washington Post. They collaborated on the new book, The Way to Win, Taking the White House in 2008. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You've probably heard by now about Bob Woodward's new book, State of Denial, his third book about the Bush administration at war. This one, as the title implies, is about conflicts within the administration about what to do in Iraq, and about intelligence reports that have been kept secret from the public that tell a much more grim and pessimistic story than what the president has told us. Woodward concludes his book by saying, with all Bush's upbeat talk and optimism, he had not told the American public the truth about what Iraq had become. Woodward interviewed President Bush four times between 2001 and 2003. The president declined to be interviewed for the new book. Nearly all of the information in the new book, Woodward says, comes from interviews with the president's national security team, their deputies, and other senior and key players in the administration responsible for the military, the diplomacy, and the intelligence on the Iraq War. I spoke with Woodward about State of Denial and the process of writing it. You write, in the 2004 presidential campaign, the real evidence of just how badly things were going in Iraq, the data and trends on the violence, the number and the effectiveness of the enemy-initiated attacks, all this was kept classified, hidden away from the voting public. Are you saying that you think the information was kept classified for campaign reasons as opposed to national security reasons?
That's a profound question. It's part political and it's part, if we advertise that we're getting that there's this level of violence, it may encourage the insurgency more and so forth. But I was quite frankly surprised to see the level of violence and that they did keep it classified. And that doesn't mean, there were lots of reports, probably some of the best ones in my own newspaper, The Washington Post, about the level of violence, but they were always focused, or almost always focused, on specific attacks. But it turned out there was an attack every hour in Iraq. I mean, think of that, an attack every hour, that's 24, 30 a day. It got to the point this year that there were attacks every 15 minutes. We haven't had one terrorist attack in this country that's been carried off in the last 5 years. To think of something where it's happening every 15 minutes or even one a day, let alone one an hour. This was never made clear and never stated, and it's one of the theme lines in the book. And that's why, in part, the book is called State of Denial, because they are denying this reality on the ground.
Well, even in your first book about the Bush administration, you write about how, President Bush doesn't really like doubt. And also, in the first
book...
Yes,
I'm glad you picked up on that, because people think, the first book I did on Bush has got all of this praise and it does have some of that, and it shows very forceful action, but there are scenes in which Condi Rice comes to him. This is after 9/11, and they have started the war in Afghanistan, and says, well, maybe we should consider alternative strategies. And he totally rejects it, meets with his war council, and does not open the door again. He goes around the table and says, look, all of you guys signed up for this. Let's be patient.
Okay, he has an aversion to doubt, and in the first book you also say that the president would not stand public discord. And I assume
Yes.
You mean discord within the administration.
Yeah, he didn't like hand-wringing. He told me for that book, because I asked about it, he said the president has to be the calcium in the backbone. And said, quite frankly, I went down and spent hours with him at his ranch in Crawford, in August of 2002. And he said if he, as president, starts expressing doubt, it will just have a ripple effect in the whole national security team, so he has to remain firm. That's one of his beliefs. Now, in the first phase of the Afghanistan war, I think you can look back on it and say he was right, because that was just a period of weeks or months after the war began. But we are now 3.5 years into this war, where most of the news, unfortunately, is bad.
Well, reading your book and seeing how members of the Bush administration publicly misrepresented the classified reports that they were getting about how badly things were going in Iraq. I kept wondering, has President Bush believed the misrepresentations, or has he not fully understood the discord between the intelligence reports and some of the public statements that he and other members of his administration have made about Iraq?
That's exactly the right question, and that's exactly why I asked to interview President Bush, and he declined, his advisors declined, and so I do not know the answer to that. I suspect, I don't want to ascribe motives, but I had lots of questions of his senior advisors and other cabinet members along these lines, and I have to be direct with you. I think that's why I didn't want to talk, because I didn't want to answer questions on this, because the discrepancy, it's not just one or two times, it's dozens of times over 3.5 years.
Now, one of the controversies about your approach now to writing about the Bush administration is that you're gathering all this information for books, and you withhold the information until the book is published. And so the question has been raised, is this the way to deal with inside information about intelligence and the Bush administration and the war in Iraq? Would the American public be better if every time you had a revelation, you published it in a daily newspaper, such as the Washington Post, which you've written for years, instead of waiting months or years to publish it in a book? So what do you say to that?
The problem is you can't just, it's not as if there's one revelation. And what you want to do is, this is an interagency government. If you find out something about the Pentagon, you want to see what the CIA angle is on it. What's the White House NSC staff angle on it? So you go back to people and you develop sources and you try to present a full picture. And I think the full picture is the most important thing.
You know what I'm wondering? Like with Watergate, you didn't wait. With Watergate, it was like every time there was new information, it was published. Now, of course, you didn't have a track record as an author yet. It was early in your career. But you found a way with Watergate to publish information as you got it.
Yes, that's right. And I had a colleague working with me, Carl Bernstein, who was probably one of the best reporters in America. I was very young, had no family, and I think as the book we wrote on this demonstrates, you work full-time, day and night, weekends. You have to be a creature of the night. I'm 63 years old and have a family, and I try to work hard, but to get in that mode, which quite frankly I did after 9/11, I have discussed this with the editors of the Post, with Don Graham, who is the CEO of the Post Company. And if I found something that was so critical that I would publish it in the newspaper. I think all of this is critical, but it all fits together.
You write that when you interviewed Rumsfeld, you submitted 29 sample questions in advance. And I guess I was surprised to read that you were submitting advance questions. Do you usually do that? I think because the assumption is if you submit questions in advance, particularly to people in the political world, that they will come up with more expert ways of spinning the answer or evading the question.
Well, it turned out that I had so much information. I mean, Rumsfeld gets to say what he wants to say, but you want some. These are busy people. You want them to know what you want to focus in on and ask. Quite frankly, you want them to prepare. In no way do you say these are the only questions I'm going to ask, and there is no limit on the questions or the issues or how you're going to conduct the interview. But quite frankly, in the case of Rumsfeld, I submitted those questions, and you're right, there were 29 of them. And Rumsfeld looked at that. Now remember, he's given no interviews for books or anything at length about post-war Iraq. He saw those questions, and I believe, and aides told me, realized I had all kinds of information, classified, inside, what he had done, what he had said. And it is those questions, I think, that caused him to say, well, A, this guy is serious. This guy has got lots of information. I'm going to sit down and respond. In this case, it worked, and there is an abundance of information I got. The whole business of the mission accomplished speech that the president gave on the aircraft carrier, the Abraham Lincoln, May 1st, 2003, Rumsfeld disclosed and said just openly when he saw the president's speech, it had mission accomplished in it. And he said, I almost died. I got it out of the speech, but not didn't get the sign down. Now, the White House has always taken the position that the mission accomplished sign was put up by the Navy and the military, and they were not responsible. Here's Rumsfeld saying it was in the speech, clearly. The White House had total responsibility for the speech. So, so many things are learned in this process. I think the value of submitting questions in advance, it works.
My guest is Bob Woodward. His new book about the Bush administration is called State of Denial. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bob Woodward. His new book, State of Denial, is his third and most critical book about President Bush at war. Correct me if I'm wrong, but my impression is there's a little more first person in here than in your previous books. And you,
yes.
You basically express your astonishment at one point that it takes President Bush about 5 minutes in an earlier interview you did with him to admit that we haven't found weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. You express astonishment at an analogy that Donald Rumsfeld uses in an interview comparing problems in Iraq with the mixed fruit in a fruit bowl.
Not just the problems, but the attacks that are killing and wounding our soldiers. He says they're like it's like a fruit bowl, apples, oranges, bananas.
Why is there more of you? Why do you allow yourself to express astonishment at what your sources within the administration are telling you in a way that you didn't allow yourself to do that in previous books?
That's a really good question. And I served in the military, in the Navy in the 60s in Vietnam. And I did not like the Vietnam War. I didn't know what to do about it. But I was stuck out on a ship or ordered around because people at the higher levels had decided on a certain policy, which I did not understand, that in fact was not explained to me. In fact, at the time, I thought was wrong and opposed. Quite frankly, I identify with the 147,000 American troops we have stuck in Iraq. I'd be honest with you. I think about them regularly, and I put myself in their shoes. And I know what they're thinking. We've reported magnificently on this in the Washington Post, frankly, by going out and interviewing sergeants and privates and officers who say, we don't quite know why we're here. One actually said in one story we published on the front page, that we're here waiting to be blown up. And so I know what it's like to have. I remember when I served in the Navy, I was extended for a year, fifth year. And at the time, I said to people, this is like a one-year Gulf of Tonkin resolution on another year of my life. And those people are stuck. They're the ones who bear the burden of this. And I feel very strongly, I'm sorry, I guess I can't bleach out my own emotions on this, that we need to explain why we're there. We need to know why we're there. We need to be truthful about what's going on. And when the Secretary of Defense, as he did in that interview with me, compares the things that are killing people to bananas, apples, and oranges, I'm speechless, as I report in the book. When the Secretary of Defense denies that he's a military commander, I quoted McNamara, the former Secretary of Defense, saying, as he does in that wonderful documentary, The Fog of War, if any military commander is honest with you, he will tell you that he's made mistakes that have cost lives. And I quoted this to Rumsfeld, and Rumsfeld said, well, yes, military commanders, and said he's not. Now, here's the number two person right after the president. And I said, no, you are by law. And I literally said, the president and Secretary of Defense to the combatant commander. And he said, well, maybe by indirection or two or three steps removed. He is a military commander. He can't take himself out of the chain of command, but he did. He said it. And I express astonishment at that. I guess that is not the voice of a reporter. That is the voice of a young lieutenant in the Navy stuck in Vietnam.
I want to go back to another story that you're involved with, and that is the leak of the fact that Ambassador Joe Wilson's wife, Valerie Plame Wilson, was a CIA agent. It turns out you were the first reporter to hear that she was a CIA agent, and you...
No, actually, I was told that she was a WMD analyst.
Okay.
Significant difference. That's why I didn't one of the reasons why I didn't think it was a big deal.
When you were told you didn't think it was a big deal?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. And you heard it from Richard Armitage.
He has said that. That's correct.
Well, knowing what you know and having been involved in the way... you know, in the way or the tangential way that you were, do you think that there is still the possibility that members of the Bush administration leaked the information that she was a CIA agent, you know, an undercover CIA agent, to discredit her?
I don't know. I mean, it's
or
pretty clear.
I should say to discredit her husband is what I mean to say.
That's the right way to phrase it. I don't know. The prosecutor has told Armitage and other people like Karl Rove that he's not going to charge them. Scooter Libby has been indicted for perjury. I think, and it may have been on your show, where I said that this investigation is laughable or is going to come to laughable results. I think that was definitely the wrong choice of words. Any investigation like that is serious. Though I was not involved in the story or the case, I had not been called. I should have thought ahead to the 10th bounce and realized it was possible I would and shouldn't have said anything about it. But I knew something about it, and I was trying to give people a clue. I don't think this is going anywhere, and as we now know, other than the indictment of Libby, it hasn't gone anywhere.
One final question. Throughout the book, you reprint haiku that was written by Colonel Steve Rotkopf, and I just want to read a couple of them.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is, "Where is WMD? What a kick if he has none. Sorry about that." And another one, "Mental bone tired, Hard to stay, not wanted. Can't rest. Men will die. These are really kind of interesting haiku, and I wonder why you decided to print them through different parts of the story in the book.
Well, my assistant Bill Murphy did the interviews on this, and the colonel was the deputy intelligence chief tasked with finding WMD, and it's a real-time expression, and I guess this goes back to the emotions of the people on the ground, and I think I included it because it is contemporaneous reaction by somebody in a very senior and sensitive position expressing his emotions about doubt and about the difficulty and about the bone tiredness of war.
Bob Woodward, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Bob Woodward's new book is called State of Denial. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of Social Intelligence, The New Science of Human Relationships by Daniel Goleman, author of Emotional Intelligence. And from Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21 Fresh. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk politics and the media with Mark Halperin, the political director of ABC News, and John Harris, the national political editor of The Washington Post. They've collaborated on the new book, The Way to Win, Taking the White House in 2008. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The rules of politics are changing, and so is the way that the media cover politics. Both sets of changes are examined in the new book, The Way to Win, Taking the White House in 2008. My guests are the authors, Mark Halperin and John Harris. Halperin is the political director of ABC News and the creator of The Note, a daily political update on abcnews.com. Harris is the national political editor of The Washington Post. He also wrote a best-selling biography of Bill Clinton called The Survivor. Mark Halper and John Harris, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, you write in your book that Bill Clinton and Karl Rove know how to win elections better than anyone of their generation. You describe Clinton as practicing the politics of the center and Rove the politics of the base. How would you define the difference between the two?
Neither strategist ignores the other tactic or the other broad strategic model. Bill Clinton, though, governed and ran as someone who said, I want to be a popular president who bridges the two parties, who fuzzes up the differences between the two parties, and who believe that the country is not fundamentally divided, but that there's a broad middle, broad agreement on a range of issues. George Bush, as a candidate in 2000, sort of followed that model. But after getting elected and throughout his presidency and in his reelection, worked with Karl Rove to pursue a much different model. They are fundamentally conservative. They think the country's institutions, including the federal government, is not as conservative as they'd like it to be and as it should be to reflect the country overall. And they've worked to change the country. They don't care about how popular George Bush is. They don't care about winning 65% of the vote. They want to win just enough of the vote in order to keep a majority and try to change the country in a conservative direction. We call it Bush politics and Clinton politics. And in talking to Karl Rove and talking to Bill Clinton for the book, they didn't disagree. They concurred with the notion that those were two separate ways of looking at things and two different models that have real practical implications for not only elections but for governing.
Bill Clinton thought the way he could succeed in a divided country was to try to transcend the political divisions and unite people. Sometimes that meant blurring his policy positions. He realized that there was no way for him to survive in office or to win re-election in 1996 unless he could elevate his own personal approval ratings. George W. Bush has a totally different model that's inspired by Karl Rove, his chief strategist, which is he prospers by clarifying the differences and using them as a wedge. So you've got one brand of politics that's unifying, the other, which is clarifying or to put it slightly more pejoratively, is divisive.
Do you think that the Democratic and Republican parties are following in those molds?
Well, I think it's sort of up for grabs now, particularly as you look at these midterm elections and also 2008. You know, the subtitle of our book, Taking the White House in 2008, every candidate who runs, whether they're a Democrat or a Republican, has to consider, do they want to run on Bush politics or Clinton politics or Clinton-Rove politics? It's easier to do that as a Republican for several reasons. Asymmetries, to use an NPR word, between the two parties. Republicans are better at targeting their messages through consumer marketing research, through the so-called new media, talk radio, the internet. They're also better at delivering a simple message and riling up base supporters. They also have that advantage of the country having more conservatives than liberals. But every candidate's got to think about how to do it.
Probably there's no figure among Democrats that's more loathed than Karl Rove. He is the devil incarnate for people on the Democratic side. But if you want to understand his influence, look at what he's done to transform not just Republican politics, but Democratic politics. Ned Lamont in Connecticut beat a sitting senator, Joe Lieberman, by using classic Rove techniques. That is, he motivated the ideological base. He got to maximum turnout. He used technology in creative ways to find voters that otherwise, under more conventional politics, simply didn't exist previously. You've got Karl Rove making his influence felt in the Democratic Party. That's why we think he's such an important strategist and worthy of study, which we do in this book.
Now, in your book, The Way to Win, you coined the term freak show politics. What does that mean, John?
The freak show is a term that Mark and I came up as we were trying to understand why American politics had become such a gaudy, destructive, sort of bloody exercise. And the freak show is, for one thing, it's the stage upon which the 2008 presidential campaign will be waged. It's a brand of politics in which the aim of the exercise is not to defeat your opponent in an argument. It is to destroy that person as a viable figure, just to make them unacceptable. It's a brand of politics which is all about attack and all about appealing to the extreme rather than finding some kind of consensus in the center.
It's where extreme voices have more influence than what we used to consider moderate voices, where politicians succeed by pandering to their base and where Laura Ingraham and Michael Moore have a lot of influence, not just in their own realm, but on what the New York Times and the Washington Post and ABC News do.
Who's a good example of being a casualty of the freak show?
Well, I think the greatest casualty of the freak show is facts and civilized debate. It's very hard with the old media news organizations, again, like the Washington Post, ABC News, and the organizations that used to dominate. We are already under pressure, declining budgets, no economic model for the future because of challenges from the internet and other things, young people not as interested in our product. All of that have left old media organizations vulnerable, and the freak show forces us down to the lowest common denominator. It shouldn't be. We should do everything we can to resist it. But we are part of the problem. We are amongst the casualties, as are anyone involved in politics. So many people who want to run for president, one of the first things and biggest things they consider is, can I withstand the scrutiny and the attacks that are going to come? We've always had attacks in American history, without question. But if you look at the era starting with Bill Clinton's presidency up through George Bush, the pervasiveness of 24-hour media, the power of these voices that used to be on the fringe and now at the center is unprecedented in American history.
You know, one person who is a casualty of freak show politics is John Kerry. There's somebody who completely lost control of his public image and his public reputation by virtue of these attacks. The Swift Boat Veterans episode is the most famous of these. But even before that, conservative operatives used this new media reality that Mark is just describing and exploited it to completely hijack John Kerry's public reputation. I think even more than that, his sense of himself. We talked at some length with Bill Clinton about this phenomenon. He gave us a lengthy interview at his home in Chappaqua about how politics has changed and about how he tried to adapt and what he did to be successful. And he said something interesting. He said, really, all great contests are head games. And that's true of politics. What he meant is, psychologically, is the psychology of competition is in this new environment is the biggest challenge. To his mind, Al Gore completely lost his self-confidence because of the attacks that were made on him in 2000. And the same thing happened to John Kerry, where for a critical period in summer of 2004, he was paralyzed and he didn't respond to the Swift Boat accusations, in part because he was so stunned that they were happening. What he thought was his strength, his war record, his personal machismo, his patriotism, was precisely the place where he was attacked and essentially decimated during that period.
My guests are John Harris and Mark Halperin, authors of the new book, The Way to Win, Taking the White House in 2008. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Mark Halperin and John Harris, authors of the new book, The Way to Win, Taking the White House in 2008. Halperin is the political director of ABC News and the creator of The Note, a political news digest on the ABC News website. Harris is the national political editor of The Washington Post and wrote a biography of Bill Clinton called The Survivor. Now, you describe the new media as favoring conservatives. And so when you're talking about new media, you're talking about talk shows, blogs, other internet sites.
Talking about Sean Hannity, Rush Limbaugh, Direct Mail, Matt Drudge, who we write about from the Drudge Report, who we write about quite a bit in the book and make clear that he has been an incredible conduit for Republicans in the last two presidential campaigns and, of course, during the Clinton years. Republicans are angry at the old media. They simply don't believe they get a fair break for them. We try to illustrate in the book why they think that. We make the argument, despite the fact that we work in the old media, that we see their point in a lot of cases, that they really do feel somewhat rightly that they don't get a fair shake. And their aggressiveness in developing these two new technologies is not only been so they can get their own voices out, but they've learned to use the new media to infect, in a sense, the old media, to how we cover things. The Swift Boat story was largely being ignored by the old media until it got so big in the new media, on cable TV, on the internet, that that became a story in and of itself, allowing, forcing our coverage in some ways, liberals would say, guiding our coverage improperly, but forcing our coverage to cover something that I think in the old days would have been ignored.
The point is not that the old media was perfect. We believe it had some basic flaws. The problem is the new media that's grown up in response to that is much worse. There's no fundamental standards and of basic ethics. The whole definition of news in the new media environment has changed. There's no such thing as neutral facts, Terry. Everything is either a weapon or a shield in this great ideological war.
And that benefits conservatives without question. And liberals, I think, are just coming to terms with it. They didn't in the last presidential election. If they're to have a chance in 2008, they better figure it out and figure out what to do about it.
And you describe the new media as really feeding the whole like freak show politics style, because, you know, in the kind of new media that you're describing, it's all about opinion and insinuation and allegation. Fact-checking is not important, as say it would be at ABC or The Washington Post, where you each work. So you can get all kinds of information out there to undercut your opponent without even worrying too much whether it's true.
Well, you don't have to worry at all about whether it's true. You know that it will be repeated and talked about, and like I said, infect the old media as well. This is a brand of politics that has no referee. People debate all the time the role of the media. The problem now is most news organizations aren't strong enough to referee, and we have such a decreasing audience size and looking over the horizon, even lower audience size, that we worry about how to stay viable. And what seems to be attractive to news consumers who are either on the left or on the right is this kind of opinion journalism, advocacy journalism, that really isn't by almost any real definition or true definition journalism. It's simply, as John said, either a weapon or a shield in this ideological conflict. And as we said before, that favors conservatives because the old system was very much stacked against them.
I would put it slightly differently than Mark. I think the old media was perhaps mildly biased in a liberal direction, but that bias was attenuated by some basic professional habits and standards. The new media, I think, is virulently biased in favor of conservatives against liberals, and it has none of those sort of professional checks.
Can you each give an example from your experiences at the Washington Post, John, and ABC, Mark, about how you think the new media has affected the stories that you've covered or how you've covered those stories?
Well, look, my job is I'm the political editor of the Post. Our campaign staff works for me. Our White House staff works for me. I can say in truth that there will be things that will appear on a place like the Drudge Report where Matt Drudge will be influencing our agenda, not necessarily on the next day's front page, but I'm going to see something, and quite often it's something that's been distributed by Republican operatives because they use Matt Drudge and go to him frequently. They know he's a favorable outlet, and that at least forces us to consider whether we wish to devote reporting about that. I might wander over to a reporter's desk and say, what about this? Is this true? So in that sense, he is influencing our agenda. And there have obviously been episodes, the most famous is back in the Clinton years during the Lewinsky scandal, but there's many, many more since then, including up to the current day, where he has effectively driven the old media's narrative.
I think the coverage of Al Gore versus the coverage of George Bush in 2000, although I do think that the press is generally biased, the old press media is generally biased in favor of Democrats. I think George Bush got much softer coverage than Al Gore, in part because the old media was driven by the new media to cover the exaggerations and the misstatements that Gore made during that campaign much more than we would have if the new media hadn't been flogging them relentlessly. Things about statements he made about whether he was the basis of the character in Love Story, statements he made about whether he discovered Love Canal. There were a number of statements that got much more attention in the new media, in the old media, than they would have if the new media hadn't flogged them. And I think more than, in most cases, more than they deserved.
You include a list of things in your book that you call trade secrets to undermine the old media. So these are ways that you think conservatives try to undermine the old media. Would you run through some of those?
When George Bush and Karl Rove came into the White House, they had pretty good relations with the press during the campaign in 2000. In fact, better relations with their press corps than Al Gore had with his. But when they came in, they recognized several things. One was they recognized that they shared the view of Richard Nixon, that the press was liberally biased against them. They also shared the view that the public didn't have much appreciation for the role of the White House and the Washington Press Corps, and therefore they could do things that would undermine even further the credibility of the press corps, and no one would, there would be no public outcry. No one would say, wait a minute, Ari Fleischer, who was the first White House press secretary in the Bush administration, how dare you insult the reporters there? So they used the White House press corps as a foil, even the wider Washington establishment, to appeal to the general public, knowing again full well that there'd be very little resistance, credible resistance from the Washington Press Corps. So there's a variety of things they did. One was they went to their old media allies because there were conservative columnists like Fred Barnes and Bob Novak in the old media. They talked to them. They didn't talk very much to reporters. As you recall, President Bush had very few press conferences early in his administration. And they also talked, of course, to the new media. They also basically stiffed the old media whenever possible and didn't really do what the old media would want. If the old media said, have press conferences, they wouldn't have press conferences. Do interviews, they wouldn't do interviews. That was another tactic they would use. They also would, at the daily briefings, very clearly try to embarrass reporters, to try to put reporters on the spot, and again, take advantage of reporters' weaknesses, not only being seen as biased by some members of the public, but also being seen with some justification in some cases, I would say, as being perhaps self-interested and lazy, as an uninformed special interest. They also would, finally, not care what was said about them. Bad coverage in the Washington Post and the New York Times, things that would drive Bill Clinton crazy, wouldn't matter to George Bush and Karl Rove, because they would know that their base, their supporters, the people they needed to get their agenda passed and to be reelected, they didn't care about what was in the Washington Post and the New York Times. A much different mindset than not only Bill Clinton had, but then the previous Republican presidents after Nixon had. And that liberated them and also served, as I said, to further weaken the old media.
Now, you think at some point that this kind of approach to dealing with the old media backfired. When and how do you think it backfired?
Well, I think, like a lot of Bush politics, this kind of press strategy, it works while things are going well. When things start to go badly, it falls apart. You have very little margin of error if you're practicing Bush politics. You're relying basically just on your base, 50% plus one, to get things done. And in the second term, as President Bush's approval ratings went down, as Hurricane Katrina occurred, they brought in a new White House press secretary, Tony Snow. The president began to meet with reporters a little bit more frequently in private and have more press conferences. And I think the problem is, the reason that has not been that effective is because I think the reporters at some point kind of turned the corner and said, we don't trust this White House. We don't believe they respect our role in a democracy. And I think the White House, to some extent, is still paying a price for that. But remember, they've got their new media allies. When they have trouble, you see Vice President Cheney sometimes going on old media platforms, but more often going on Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity to get their message out to their supporters. That's who they want to reach. And, of course, in those venues, you often get more friendly questions, and you force the old media to pick up that information because it's the only place it's available.
Conservatives often accuse the press of being liberal and of asking challenging questions because they have a liberal bias. Now, very recently, Bill Clinton was on Fox News talking to Chris Wallace. And Chris Wallace, this was after the broadcast of the September 11th movie. And Chris Wallace said to President Clinton, why is it that you didn't do more to stop a terrorist attack? And, you know, Bill Clinton got really angry and said, you know, said, first of all, that you're asking me that because, you know, Fox News is so conservative. And then he made his case about how at least he tried, whereas Bush didn't even try before September 11th. Were you surprised at how Bill Clinton handled that and how he used that as an opportunity to accuse Chris Wallace of kind of representing Fox News as a conservative outlet and therefore asking that critical question?
I wasn't surprised because, you know, having followed Clinton for a good long time and, in fact, having talked about this very subject with him for a couple of hours for purposes of this book, both Mark and I knew very much how he feels. One of the big lessons for Democrats, he believes, is you have to be aggressive in challenging conservative attempts to define you as and to make you unacceptable in the public mind. He thinks Al Gore failed because he was not aggressive enough in doing that. John Kerry failed because he wasn't aggressive enough in doing that. He was doing something very purposeful in that interview. He was showing, I think, the country, but in particular Democrats, look, here's how it's done. You fight back. You respond to these allegations and go on the attack. You get in their face. Do not let them define you. I think in the course of doing that, he did genuinely lose his temper, and the public saw what people who have worked with Clinton and even those of us who are reporters who followed him for a long time have seen with some regularity. He's got a temper. He got mad. But that was a very purposeful thing he was doing in getting mad.
My guests are John Harris and Mark Halperin, authors of the new book, The Way to Win, Taking the White House in 2008. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guests are Mark Halperin and John Harris. They're the authors of the new book, The Way to Win, Taking the White House in 2008. And Halperin is the political director of ABC News. Harris is the national political editor for The Washington Post. Each of your news organizations has had big stories in the past few days that could have an impact on the midterm elections. For ABC News, it was the story of Congressman Mark Foley's emails to Pages. And for the Washington Post, you know, Bob Woodward, who's still affiliated with the Post, has his new book, State of Denial, his third book about the Bush administration. And the Washington Post published an excerpt of that book. You know, that book and the Mark Foley story could have an impact on the 2006 elections. And I'm wondering, I'll ask each of you to talk about your news organization's story and what impact you think it might have.
Well, in the case of ABC, we thought we were just doing a story about one congressman from a relatively safe congressional district. I don't think we knew. I certainly didn't know for sure the congressman would resign. And, of course, it's the real fallout from the story that might have potential impact for 2006 midterms is the way congressional leaders handled it. The Republican leaders seem to have at least some knowledge of some of Mark Foley's actions, and that could well affect the outcome of the election. We are very careful and very cautious when it comes to political story near an election to think through, make certain, double certain we're doing the right thing. But it's also unfair to hold back a story, even though it's close to the election, if it's a story in the public interest. These are hard decisions. Often, in this case, it wasn't a hard thing. This was obviously a very important story and one, like I said, the political implications of which we didn't think all the way through because we didn't know what they'd be.
When Bob Woodward is working on a book, those of us in the Post are aware of it, but often unaware of the particular avenues that he's taking in his reporting or what he's going to come back with. And so in the weeks before, you hear these rumblings. And Bob, you know, and rightfully so, doesn't give much away. But he had told us that the material in this book is something that was, he felt, going to figure prominently in the elections. And I think, you know, since the book's been out on Sunday, he has delivered on that.
What do you see when you look ahead in 2006? Are you willing to predict whether the Democrats will regain a majority in either the House or the Senate?
I'm not willing to make a hard prediction. I think until the Foley story broke, that talking to everyone, every source I've got in both parties, it seemed people thought this thing was sort of at a tipping point, that the Democrats could take the House and or the Senate, but that it wasn't a sure thing by any means. I think the Republicans had a good couple of weeks and were feeling better about things. And I think Democrats were feeling a little bit worried, a little bit like Charlie Brown. They try to kick that football one more time and fail. The Foley story has really shaken things up, and I think we're right in the midst of it now. It's impossible to say what will happen. There is concern in the Republican Party that this is something they think voters will understand. that it could hurt them with all types of voters, with female voters and older voters and religious voters. And they're anxious to try to end the story, but it keeps on growing. They thought by now they'd have contained it. They have not. And I think at this point, if you were betting, you'd certainly be pushing more money towards the Democratic side of the table than you would just of a few days ago.
John, what do you think?
I've always felt that Bush politics, which worked effectively in 2004, was reaching the end of its rope, that the country was wearying of the particular tactics that Karl Rove had used and was wearying of the sort of reliance on wedge politics. I felt it was reaching its natural life. I think the events of the past month or so have tended to bear that out. I've always felt this was going to be likely a Democratic year. And I don't think it's going to be overwhelming, but I think it's quite likely that Democrats will take control of at least one chamber of Congress.
Mark, I have one personal question for you. I'm not very personal. It's biographical. Your father, Morton Halperin, worked in the Nixon administration in the National Security Council. He supervised the writing of the Pentagon Papers, which was the secret history of the U.S. involvement in Vietnam. And after the Pentagon Papers were leaked to the New York Times, Nixon and Kissinger ordered the wiretapping of your father's home phone. I don't know how old you were then, but I'm wondering how that affected the family political environment that you grew up in and how that might have affected you in the long run as a journalist who covers politics.
Well, I was all of 4 and 5 years old during that tap went on for 21 months. You know, I think there's two things. One is this country, particularly after September 11th, but throughout its history, has always had debates about the balance between national security and civil liberties. And the country, I think, often is more, at times of war, is more prone, more directed towards the national security side. But I'm pretty sensitive to those debates and the difficulty in a democracy of balancing them. I think the other thing is, as a journalist, is it's an easy thing to forget, but history proves it again and again, is that often people at the top of governments lie and break the law. And you have to, as a journalist, be a patriot and you have to be respectful. But you also have to be skeptical and questioning of government authority at all times because history shows that it is often abused.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you for taking time. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Terry.
Mark Halperin and John Harris are the authors of the new book, The Way to Win, Taking the White House in 2008. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from TIAA CREF, serving the financial needs of those in the academic, medical, cultural, and research fields. Online at tiaacref.org/greatergood. From KC Family Programs, a national foundation working to improve the lives of the 800,000 children who experience foster care every year at kc.org. And from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Oscar Wilde's The Picture of Dorian Gray, available in stores and online at bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, James Baker. He served as Chief of Staff and Secretary of the Treasury under President Reagan, Secretary of State and Chief of Staff under President George H.W. Bush, and he represented the Bush-Cheney campaign during the 2000 Florida recount. Baker has written a new memoir. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.